Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Well, depending on the type of parent you are either deeply concerned about the time when your kids go off to college or university, or you're excited about it. Some parents will be overjoyed when the kid leaves the nest, as I'm projecting there. But certainly, this phase in your life can come with its own emotional and financial challenges for you, for the parent. Certified financial planner Matt Moline wrote a book called Empty Nest, Full Pockets, which details strategies to help you prepare. He's going to be here to talk about it. Then, do you feel confident when it comes to your finances? Conscious Economics and Interact have created an educational program called Mindfulness and Money to help you take control of your cash. Rhiannon Roslin is the creator and CEO of Conscious Economics, and she'll be here to take us through what you can learn from it. And you know you need to have a good credit score to do a lot of things and have a lot of things. But the rating system is far from perfect. Writer Emily Baron Cadloff wrote this great piece about credit scores, the history, the challenges for The Walrus. And she's going to be here to talk about credit scores and how they can sometimes run and ruin our lives. Then central bankers are starting to get very, very interested in digital currencies. McGill University finance professor Katrin Tin will be here to talk about what this could mean for Canadians. Plus, I look at two of the ways that can help you get out of debt. I'll be speaking to Stacey Yanchuk-Oletsky, CEO of Credit Counseling Canada, about the difference between two things, the difference between a debt consolidation program versus a consumer proposal, and how to know which one might be a better fit for you. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. Some parents dread the thought, and some can't wait to send their kids off to college or university and reclaim that extra bedroom for scrapbooking or some such purpose. But for many people, regardless of whether you're excited or not excited, this phase in life can come with its own emotional and even financial challenges. Certified financial planner Matt Moline can relate to not looking forward to having an empty nest. So he wrote a book that covers strategies to help parents prepare and teens too. It is called Empty Nest, Full Pockets: How to Emotionally and Financially Prepare for You and Your Child's Future. He joins us now from Des Moines, Iowa. Hello there.
Good afternoon. Good to talk with you.
Canada and the U.S. are similar, but also different. Our tuition fees aren't as high as many schools in the U.S. Our education savings plans work a little differently. But I think there is a universal truth that that you can probably articulate for parents and have in common with parents in terms of the mixed feelings you have as your four kids walked out that door. What has the transition been like for you?
Yeah, we likened it in the book to a tug of war, because it is like you mentioned, boy, it would be maybe nice if they weren't here all the time, but then the thought of them leaving can be very disheartening as well. And so that tug of war of emotion, they're going through it, you're going through it. They're wanting to become more independent. They get a taste of it and they like it. You feel like you've been abandoned. You work so hard to be a great parent to these kids and teach them all these life lessons that they're now either disregarding or ignoring. And there's just almost a feeling of abandonment sometimes. But what we found is on the other side of that, there is great joy and adventure as well for everybody, for all parties concerned.
We talk a ton about saving for a kid's education and, you know, how that begins ideally the day that they're born. What we talk less about is this particular phase in which, you know, you've either done the savings or you haven't, but they're headed off regardless. What are some of the financial dynamics that are ever present for kids as they move out, for kids and parents, as they move out and begin this journey?
For the kids, they're going to be learning about money in a new way, and that they're going to have to help do more of the management on their own. My son's second or third weekend in school, he called me and said, I had no idea how expensive life was, quote unquote. And so they're having to see money move in and out of their wallets maybe more frequently than since the time that we've taken care of them. And then for the parents, it's really finding that balancing act of, you have a future now to be thinking about. And we've spent so much time, money, invested in our kids, we sometimes forget that we have a future to be thinking about. And so we can't jeopardize that in totality for then our assistance of the kids and their needs. So finding that, striking that balance is good work, but it's hard work.
What did you say to their kids before they left your family home about where you would catch them if they fell? Could they pick up the phone and say, I now don't have enough money for food? Would your response have been, here's $500? Or would your response have been, you need to get a job?
It would have been both. So if there was an emergency of sorts, I would have helped. This goes to a lot of the family dynamics and kind of the money mindsets of the family. Some are strong believers in really assisting the kids along the way as much as they can. Others feel like they need to bootstrap it. And so finding, again, a balance there to say, I'll help with this, but I expect this in return, and or I don't want to go through this again. So let's develop a plan.
You have four children, which frankly was irresponsible. I'm one of five. It's irresponsible. I mean, just what are the economics of that? How did you think about undergrad versus what may happen after that? Because in some families, this is a ticket to ride that can go to a second undergrad degree, a master's, a PhD. And in other families, it's like, listen, we barely have enough to support you, you know, to put groceries in your fridge during that 4 years, let alone another degree.
So we set a parameter of what we would pay for. In our case, in Iowa, the in-state schools are very, very good schools. And there's, unless they had something very specific they wanted to study, would give them a good return on their investment and our investment as well. And so we set that expectation. If they wanted to move outside of that, they would be on the hook for the cost differential. So we tried to set a baseline of this is where we can help and will help, and this is where we won't.
Did you require that they work in the summers between terms?
I did, unless they were going to school. So like the first year, the freshman year, we encouraged them not to work. And so we had them working there in high school years to save up some money. And then we supported them. And if they're living on campus in America anyway, they have the meal plans. So they have very little extemporaneous cash that they needed that first year. But then from there, we did expect in the summers, in many cases, my kids ended up staying at their schools and working either at the university or in a business surrounding that area, because we had to pay rent in the summers, whether they were living there or not. So I began to encourage them to stay there and be productive.
What did you notice about having teenagers living under your roof and I'm sure eating you out of house and home, and then moving to a world in which there weren't teenagers under your roof? Was that an increase in expenses overall? Was it a decrease in expenses?
It was a decrease in monthly expenses. And a lot of parents don't realize that your income is going to support some of your tuition expense because you're not feeding them and you're not, just a number of the things that you're doing for them now you won't be doing. That'll be happening at school. And so if you've saved for school and they're going to eat and live there, that those expenses can be anywhere from what, $500 to $1,000 a month, depending on the kid. Now, I had a big football playing kid and I've never seen a human being eat like him. So when he was gone, I felt like we were saving thousands on groceries. So it depends on each kid, but there's definitely some savings there. And when we do a plan for parents, we do count that to say, you're going to have this freed up income, either money that you've been saving for school and or these monthly expenses that are going to change.
As I mentioned, I'm one of five. And one of our complaints as siblings was we would often say, life is not fair. How did you navigate fairness amongst your four kids? And how did you even go about defining it? Because in our family, fair was not equal. And we knew that from, you know, a very young age.
This is rampant with my twins. They're always over their shoulder. He got this, she got that. And so we just did our best to say, listen, in your next life, you'll probably have perfect parents and they'll figure all of this out for you and it'll be 50-50. But we're doing the best that we can, and everything isn't going to be fair. And maybe that's one of the best lessons that we can teach kids is that, you know, life isn't fair. I was just listening to Matthew McConaughey's autobiography, and he's talking about that, how that being a great lesson for him. He went to Australia and it was rough. It was unfair, lots of it, but it taught him so much about life. And so things aren't always fair. And so as parents, we want to do the best that we can, but also accept that there's life lessons and maybe some things having to be a dirge or a struggle.
One of the big challenges that parents face is the trade-off between their lives and in retirement and the success of their children and the amount that they would put towards education. In a world of finite resources, how do you help clients make what is a very personal decision in terms of where those dollars are best spent based on the values of that family?
We have the family go through a pre-approval process like you would for a mortgage. So we say, if here's how much you're going to be paying for school, here's how much you've saved, here's what your monthly income looks like. So this is the type of school that you can afford. This is the amount that would work for your family on an annual or four-year basis or whatever they're looking at, and then drill into the schools from there. So if they know that, they have their arm with that knowledge, and that's a family conversation to say, kids, this is what we can afford. This is what that looks like. If you want something more, now we move into the student loan arena and some of those. And what your life as a this for the student when they're out, what kind of income they can expect, and what that student loan debt might mean for where they want to live and how they want to live.
What insight would you provide for parents on the power dynamic? And I say that because some parents fund education no strings, some parents fund education with lots of strings and ones that they can justify. So I will pay for this particular program, I will not pay for that program. You will work and I will pay, you don't work, I won't pay. How do you help parents figure out what is right for their family?
So we take them through an exercise called Fiscalosophy, and it helps me understand what their financial philosophies are and some of the money messages that they're living with, many of those that we take from our own childhood, our own parents. And so in the book, I do a story about Jack and Diane about, one had everything and one had nothing. And so helping them see and understand their partner and how they're evaluating this decision, and then how the decision will financially affect them. So bringing some of those numbers forward can be helpful in seeing this is not going to work. And if you do this, it's going to delay, your dream of being done at 62, for instance. Mm-hmm. There's no way that's going to happen if they go to this school with this type of expense. So where can we find some compromise and reinforcing their role as a mentor now versus perhaps more of a dictator, like when the kids are younger. Right. Good to stand alongside them in this process, but having them learn some of it and go through some of it, fill out the applications and the scholarships and the essays and all the stuff that goes with that. So stepping back, allowing them to make mistakes, but being a mentor and helping them learn from the things that you've learned all these years.
Really interesting stuff. Matt, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Bruce. It's been great.
Matt Moline is a certified financial planner. He is also the author of Empty Nest, Full Pockets, How to Emotionally and Financially Prepare for You and Your Child's Future.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
In times of economic uncertainty, a lot of people can feel like they've really lost control of their finances, of their future. A new partnership between Conscious Economics and Interact is looking to help Canadians build financial confidence. They have started this community-led educational program called Mindfulness and Money. Rhiannon Roslin, creator and CEO of Conscious Economics, joins us now to talk about the program. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you? Thank you so much for having me.
It should go without saying, but I'm going to ask you to put a fine point on it. Why is financial confidence so important?
Yeah, well, really our finances and our money are at the center of everything in our lives, whether it's our jobs, our relationships, our well-being, our mental health. So really it is the most important thing. Yet so many Canadians are still so uncomfortable about speaking about it, about addressing the things that make them feel like they're not confident. And this is what we really want to change with this program.
What is Conscious Economics? I mean, I kind of think I know, but I don't know.
Yeah, Conscious Economics is a not-for-profit organization. And I like to explain it like this. Consciousness, another word for consciousness, is a deeper awareness. So we are bringing a deeper awareness to all things economy. We talk about the people, planet, profit, art revolution that is happening right now, which is what I call the new economy. And it's really about us having a deeper, more therapeutic lens into the emotional and social impacts that our relationship with money and the economy have. So we take our participants and our members on a journey of actually self-discovery and understanding what they picked up in childhood, what they picked up societally that impacts their relationship with money. And we help them to improve their relationship to money from that lens and that perspective.
Interact is your partner on this particular program. I know Conscious Economics does other things, but what do you hope participants will learn from their engagement with this program?
We really hope that participants are going to start to understand what the psychological, emotional, and social blocks are that are preventing them from feeling financially confident. So like you mentioned, this is a community-led initiative. Interact has been a supporter of Conscious Economics for over 5 years. I love working with them because they have nothing to sell. They have nothing to prove other than they want to see Canadians doing well with their money. So this was a great partnership. And what I really enjoy about the program, and I've done it obviously myself in creating it, is that it can uncover and open up our minds to some of the little things that are hidden deep in our subconscious that are impacting our relationship. So let me give you an example. I grew up in a single parent household and money was always a struggle. In fact, you know, I watched my mom work double, you know, shifts and jobs, but still be struggling to pay the bills. So I had this feeling like money is always a struggle. And even when I grew up and I started to earn a great income, I started to overspend so that I would just still be in that struggle, even though it wasn't related to my income or what I was generating. It was something that I had subconsciously imprinted inside of me. And until I went deep down and started to do some of the work to excavate that, I was repeating this pattern, even though my circumstances didn't require it. So I know that sounds a little complex. We are embedding financial therapy into this program. I know you've had Asil Albaba, who is one of Canada's only financial therapists, and she was instrumental in this particular project as well. So I really encourage folks to go to conscious-economics.ca and try the program out for yourself. It's self-led modules. They're easy. They're actually beautiful to watch, community-led experts. So it's not, you know, your traditional financial literacy, you know, educators. These are real people with real stories and real lives. And I think that people will find this very relatable.
Asil is amazing, and she has great, great perspective on this world. I'm looking at your core educators. These are not names, faces, and job titles that we would have been exposed to in the last 25, 30 years. In fact, there's two mindfulness and well-being coaches. So they would bring, you know, first and foremost, expertise in mindfulness. How tough was it for you to bring that, make that intersection to the personal finance dynamic? Yeah. Was that an easy connection or was it harder?
You know what? It's been a journey. It's been 10 years that I've been working in financial literacy. I was the founder of the Junior Economic Club of Canada, which had me traveling all across the country. And I gotta say that I had this realization, and it was about 2017. I was up in the Arctic of Canada working with some incredible Inuit leaders. And I realized that traditional financial literacy doesn't actually work if we don't address some of the emotional and social things that are preventing us from feeling empowered around money. So even for myself, I could have known all of the things. I knew how to budget, I knew how to save, I knew how to invest, but because of my trauma from childhood of growing up in a low income situation, I was still not applying some of those things that even I knew as an educator. So as I went on my own healing journey myself with money, I started to work with incredible mindfulness and wellness coaches. And that's where Sheena and Gary, who are both our wellness and mindfulness coaches. And I also want to highlight the diversity of our teachers. You know, we are a diverse country here. Many of us have different journeys, whether we've, you know, immigrated to Canada, whether our parents were first generation. There's all these different layers that impact our way that we see ourselves within the economy and with our relationship with money. And both Gary and Sheena, our wellness coaches, are really well-versed in healing communities of color and ensuring that those folks that have felt they were on the outside of maybe the inner circle of money and finance are being invited in this gentle and loving way. It's really about healing, and it's a time to heal. Look what's happening in the world right now. There's so much uncertainty around money and finance, and you know, look at just the economy, the uncertainty, the inflation, all of it. So we need tools. And I want people to know that you can change your relationship with money. You can feel more confident with your money and your resources. And it's not about always how much you're bringing in. It's about healing some of these things that really impact our heart. And I know that sounds weird saying heart, saying money in the same sentence, but that's what conscious economics is really all about. Taking this new and loving approach to the topic that impacts so many of us.
It doesn't sound remotely weird here because we live at the intersection of those two things. One last question before we go. The stark reality for most Canadians, particularly in these times, given rising interest rates and rising inflation and all that stuff, is that they need to make trade-offs, harder trade-offs than they would have needed to make even 2 years ago.
Yes.
How does that challenge get woven into the work that you're doing?
Well, I want to answer that in two ways. Firstly, Interact conducted some incredible research, and we were really seeing that we're up to 61% of Canadians saying that they're feeling an uncertainty and a financial anxiety that's preventing them from feeling confident with their money. We're seeing millennials and Gen Z, women, and those earning under $50,000 particularly impacted right now. And I want to put this out to your listeners. When we are in these challenging times, it's very easy to go into a lack mindset, meaning that we're thinking about all the ways that we have to contract, all the ways we have to pull back. I want you to think about this time with still the mindset of abundance. And what I mean by that is, instead of thinking about, oh, I've got to pull this off my, you know, spending for this month, or I've got to take these things away, how can you collaborate with your neighbors? How can you come together with people in your community and build infrastructure, build things together that are less, you know, you're each contributing, but you're actually contributing more. So of example, instead of going out and pretending that you can keep up with everybody, if you really can't, why not come together with your community and saying, we're going to come together and we're going to help cook a beautiful meal together, spending time together. These things, we've lost this so much in our society in this consumer-driven culture that's being fed to us. We forget that the real currencies of life are love, togetherness. And I know that that may sound like, oh yeah, sure, that doesn't pay the bills. It actually can. You can figure out ways to pool resources with people. I'm having friends right now that are talking about selling their homes and literally like moving in with other couples. Like, we got to do what we got to do. The world is where it's at. And there's no shame in us literally changing our whole entire paradigm around how we live, how we operate with each other, the planet, and our finances.
It's amazing. Rhiannon, thank you for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Bruce.
Rhiannon Roslin is the creator and CEO of Conscious Economics. She joined us to talk about their program, which is a partnership with Interact and Conscious Economics, called Mindfulness and Money. Coming up next on Moolala, I'll speak with writer Emily Baron Kadloff about the credit rating system. You've heard about Equifax and TransUnion, probably. How does all that work? Why did it evolve into the system that it is today? And later, McGill University finance professor Katrin Tin joins us to talk about digital currencies and what they may mean for the future of central banking. Don't forget, we have a newsletter, a Moolala newsletter. You will be able to stay up to date on all the fun things that we've done on this show and on other interviews that I've done on CBC Radio or CityLine or BNN Bloomberg, blah, blah, blah. To sign up for that newsletter, you go to moolala.ca, moolala.ca.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. Credit scores, credit scores, credit scores. We talk about credit scores on this show a lot, and we talk about them because they can be so important to your financial life. Not just the basics about getting a particular credit card or qualifying for a mortgage or an installment loan, but even so far as how they can affect your ability to get a job. They are important. What we don't spend a lot of time talking about, and we should, and we're going to correct that today, is things like, how did the credit rating system become such a huge part of our lives? Where does it go wrong? What are the challenges with the system? Emily Barron-Cadloff wrote this piece in The Walrus, and I was fascinated by it and insisted that she join us to talk about it. Emily, hello there.
Hello.
You began your piece with a story about a woman named Angela Monahan. The credit bureau assumed she was dead when she was very much alive. What impact did that have on her?
Angela was at a Canadian Tire and wanted to apply for a credit card from the store. She couldn't. And so she was sitting on a piece of patio furniture at the Canadian Tire on the phone to TransUnion when she learned that they thought she was dead. And her credit score was effectively wiped to zero because dead people do not have credit scores. And that took almost 2 years to clear up. And so in that time, she could not open any new credit products. She could not get a new mortgage. She could not work with anyone who needed to check a credit score, which obviously threw her whole life into disarray. But what was especially troubling for Angela is that, in fact, it was her husband who had died, and the credit bureau had mixed the two of them up. And so every single month when she went back to TransUnion and said, please fix this, she had to continue to let them know about her late husband. And so it was a very painful process.
Now, as tragic and ridiculous as this story is, mistakes happen. What I don't understand about the story, and maybe you can illuminate this, is why it took so long. Like, there she is. She is a human being. She's got financial records. She has ID. She is living and breathing and talking to them on the phone. Why did it take 2 years?
That is a question that Angela herself had many times. And so the answer that she was given is that because the credit score and an algorithm is automated, it is not a human being. She's a human being, but it is not a human being that is manually calculating people's credit scores. It is a automated algorithm. And so the a person at TransUnion might go in and fix her notification and check the box that says this woman is alive. But the next month, when that credit report comes in, that algorithm can override it because it was an automated system. And so it took a long time for them to sort of get far enough back, I suppose, in the code, if you want to think of it like that, to really fix the problem at the root.
I was the victim of identity theft this past year, and I saw my credit score plummet in a week. It took me 4 months. And that seemed ridiculous because basically it was like, it didn't happen. My identity was stolen. Fix it. In your research, how common is this? I'm sure you heard lots of anecdotes. Did you get any stats?
No, and that's part of the problem. We know that there are lots of issues, things like Sure, identity theft, but even things like your name is spelled wrong, or perhaps you're listed at an old address instead of your current address, that sort of thing. And we sort of know anecdotally that this happens all the time. But one of the things is because credit bureaus are legislated at both federal and provincial level, but generally provincially, there are different bodies that are getting different stats. So we know, for instance, that like Ontario might have received 10 complaints last month, but we don't know if that's all of the problems or just those 10 people called in to complain.
I know a lot about the system today because it's relevant to my work, but I know little about the history. It's just an is. It's always been this way. Part of your article goes into the history and the evolution of the credit bureaus in North America. What did you find about where the purpose changed, where things shifted that might illuminate why it is so complex and problematic today?
That's a great question. And the history itself is vast. And I would encourage your listeners to read Creditworthy by Josh Lauer, which is a book that I read a lot for this piece and interviewed him for. I think one of the big points is that initially when credit bureaus were first forming, it was really when cities were starting to industrialize and get bigger. And so it was impossible for individual shop owners to really have the same kind of personal relationship with people as they may have done previously. So they started getting credit managers to keep track of people and whether or not they would be trustworthy to get credit for the tailor shop or the baker or whatever you might have. And then those credit managers started to band together. One of the things that I think shifted is rather than just going, oh, does this person pay me back on time for the loaf of bread that I baked? Those credit managers started noting things like, does this person go to church? Does this person drink alcohol? Does this person cheat on their wife? Whoa. They started noting everything, all these kinds of personal details. And so credit really has a history of very subjective and biased reporting on credit. Now, obviously, I want to be clear that current day credit bureaus do not track those things. But we can see a pattern in who might have been able to accumulate generational wealth, right?
And where it is relevant today is in some of the biases that exist because of living circumstances, for example. So you spoke to Keith Martell of First Nations Bank of Canada. We've had him on this show. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that he highlighted that are disadvantages for Indigenous communities?
Right. Keith had some great points. I think the thing that was most interesting to me is that one of the biggest things that can impact your credit score is getting a mortgage. It's likely the biggest purchase that most people will make in their lifetime, and it has a huge impact on your credit score. If you live, say, on a First Nation, on a reserve within Canada, that you oftentimes, not always, but often, don't actually own your house in the same way that you might if you had a mortgage in, I live in the middle of Halifax. So it may not work in the same way if you lived in the middle of Halifax. The First Nation itself owns the house and you pay the First Nation. So you may not have a traditional mortgage. Thus, you may not build your credit score in the same way. And then it can, again, perpetuate this system of inequality.
Now, is there any energy from any part of the regulatory or political bodies that serve Canada to make change to the way this system works? Or is it as intractable or determined as which side of the road we drive on?
I could never say that it is as determined and intractable as such a thing. Who's to say? What I can say is, yeah, there's some grumbling, there's some noise, but it does not seem at this moment that this is a particular issue that it has a lot of fire underneath it. I would say certainly for people like Angela or other people who have had to deal with these systems, absolutely, there is cause for change. And there are, you know, grassroots groups and different, you know, sort of individual activist groups that would absolutely push for change. Mm. Whether or not we're going to see it in Parliament tomorrow, that seems unlikely.
I think the answer is no.
That now, seems unlikely. Yeah.
One last question before we go. When we think about our data, and certainly there's a breadth of people's sensitivity around their personal data. If you don't want your data to be used by social media, don't go on social media. You don't want it to be used by internet search providers, don't go on Google. When it comes to your credit score, that information is all reported behind your back. You don't know. How concerned does that make you about privacy and security and?
Well, the unfortunate thing is that if we want to exist in this society as we do, we really can't avoid it. So there is concern. I mean, certainly these credit bureaus, Equifax had a major breach of privacy and millions of pieces of data were leaked. That happens. But the alternative is you use only cash, you live outside of the system, you have zero credit score, and then you cannot do things like buy a plane ticket anymore because you can't do that in person in cash. So, like, it would drastically impact my life. So while there is concern with this stuff, at this point, it feels a little bit like it's a concern that we may have to live with unless something drastically changes. And what that thing might be is has to be transparency. That's the thing. The system needs to be more transparent so that we know that what this data that they're collecting is and how it's disseminated.
Yeah. Well, Emily, I really appreciate you taking the time to join us to talk about what you learned about the black box that is credit scores.
Thank you very much for having me.
Emily Barron-Kadloff is a journalist who wrote this really great piece in The Walrus about the history of credit scores, some of the problems that that are not uncommon in that world, and maybe some ideas on what could change down the road.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, I'll speak with McGill University professor Katrin Tin about central bank digital currencies. But first, Stacey Yanchuk-Oletsky talks about the differences between a debt consolidation program versus a consumer proposal. Really helpful stuff if you've got a level of consumer debt that you are just having a hard time managing. For more Moolala, head to moolala.ca. You can listen to past episodes, like full episodes, or you can listen to specific segments based on the topic or the guest name. Also, all the podcast programs, all the big podcast programs or platforms like Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Prime, all those places you can download the show, write a review, even subscribe to the next episode. So it's just already on your device when you're ready to listen to something great.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
So maybe you have debt. Maybe you have a lot of debt. And maybe you need more help than just some, you know, budgeting tips and a kind word. There are a couple of interventions that you may want to consider. And we're going to talk about two of them today. One is something called a debt consolidation program through a nonprofit credit counselor. And the second is a consumer proposal through a licensed insolvency trustee. For more on how each of these work and which might be a better fit for you based on your circumstances, we're speaking to Stacey Yanchuk-Oletsky. She is the CEO of Credit Counseling Canada, which is the association that represents nonprofit credit counselors in Canada. She joins us from Agassiz, British Columbia. Did I say that right, Stacey? Agassiz?
You didn't. It's Agassiz, BC, but that's okay. We'll go with it.
That's much. I was just going to say Vancouver area, but that's, I love sure. that. It's so good. What is a debt consolidation program? How do you define that?
Sure. What a debt consolidation program, Bruce, is, it's for about 20% of consumers. So it's not the right solution for everybody, but what it is it consolidates debt into a reasonable monthly payment. So let's just take, I'm going to use my middle name, Leanne, as an imaginary person. And so let's say Leanne has five different unsecured debts. And let's say she's just struggling, you know, maybe she's in collections with one or two, or maybe she's just making minimum payments and getting nowhere fast. What a nonprofit credit counseling agency can do is help pool her debts into what's called a debt consolidation program. So what happens is that agency will send proposals out to her creditors, and assuming that she can make a payment, you know, in her budget, then they will accept those proposals typically. And now Leanne just has to make one payment every month to that agency. And what that agency does, Bruce, on her behalf is they disperse those funds to her creditors. And in return, because she's actually paying 100% of her principal back, what they're going to do is they're going to give her a break on the interest. So most creditors will drop the interest down to zero. And even the high interest ones will drop it down to, you know, something a lot more reasonable. So Leanne, a consumer, can get out of debt in a reasonable amount of time with a debt consolidation program.
What then is a consumer proposal?
Mm-hmm. A consumer proposal is a legal solution. So this is done by a licensed insolvency trustee. And what it is a consumer, if they cannot afford to pay back 100% of the principal, then what they can do is work with a trustee to establish a consumer proposal. And this is where they will pay a portion of their debt back. So let's go back to Leanne. Instead of owing, let's say, $30,000, she would maybe owe $15,000. So she'd pay a portion of her debt back by making monthly payments, so that within 5 years, she would also become debt-free.
What are some of the circumstances that a credit counselor would look at to determine whether that DCP, the debt consolidation program, is a better fit for Leanne versus a consumer proposal?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, what I've always been excited about in the nonprofit credit counseling field is really our philosophy has been about helping consumers be as responsible as they financially can be. And so what that credit counselor does is look at her whole situation. And if she's able to afford a payment in her budget, and that's the key, Bruce, is that this is not about, you know, eligibility. She has to be able to afford it and still have a, you know, maintain a reasonable standard of living, then perhaps the debt consolidation program is the best thing. But the numbers will dictate that solution. And if she cannot pay that 100% back, then she may look at a consumer proposal.
Both of these paths have an impact on your credit score. Tell us about the impact that will be with you after you have completed either the consumer proposal or the debt consolidation program.
Sure. So let's talk about a couple of things. First of all, it's important to differentiate that in a DCP, a debt consolidation program, it's a voluntary program. So three folks, if you will, have to volunteer. So Leanne, the consumer, her creditors, as well as the nonprofit credit counseling agency. In a consumer proposal, it is not a voluntary program. It's actually a legal program. It's a legal solution. So, you know, what we're looking at is, you know, what fits best. And in terms of credit, they both will impact their credit ratings at 7 after successful completion. The DCP, the debt consolidation program, will come off after 2 years, but never stay longer than 6. And for consumer proposal, it'll be 3 years after successful completion. But there's also another difference that we have to note, Bruce, is that with the debt consolidation program, because it's voluntary, once it's come off the credit report, it's done. No one knows about it other than, you know, the agency and that consumer, Leanne. But with a consumer proposal, it actually remains on public records. So what that means is it comes off the credit report, but it'll stay on public records.
So that if an employer is looking at your credit score, they would be able to see that.
That's right. Or as I used to joke when I was teaching workshops, if I was, you know, doing my first, if I was dating, you know, I'd probably be on the Office of the Superintendent's bankruptcy website, you know, to see if my date has gone bankrupt before.
Oh, can you, anybody can look that up?
Anybody can look that up. I believe it's $8 now. They've gone back between free and $8, but I think you have to pay a little bit, but
right.
Yeah,
and,
it is
and
a public
it,
record.
Both consumer proposals and bankruptcy filings. Interesting. Okay. Now, in both situations, you do not walk out of there with the same ability to use credit as you did before you signed off on one of these two programs or proposals. How do clients work around that? Credit cards are ubiquitous these days.
Sure they are. Well, there's a couple of ways, you know, and I think that we've gotten a little bit credit, you know, crazy, if you will, that we're so focused on credit scores and well, credit scores, not even our reports. What we need to know is that credit can go up and credit can go down. And so there are multiple ways to build credit without getting into high interest debt. So you can build credit, and whether that person's on a consumer proposal or a DCP, a debt consolidation program, they can build it with a cell phone contract in their name. They can also build it with a secured credit card. And then upon successful completion, they can also look at small, you know, unsecured credit cards to build credit. We don't need a ton of products to actually rebuild our credit. What we need is time and good behavior.
So with the DCP, you pay those debts back in full, admittedly at a much lower interest rate. With a consumer proposal, you don't pay those debts back in full. Who determines how many cents on the dollar you end up paying?
So it's a great question. So when a consumer, so let's go back to Leanne, when she meets with a licensed insolvency trustee, they'll look at their whole financial situation and propose to creditors what she should be paying. And that will be based on her budget, you know, her monthly expenses and her income, as well as her assets. And so a licensed insolvency trustee will send proposals out to those creditors and then they can vote on it.
Why would someone choose a DCP when they will pay less with a consumer proposal? So you flagged two things, but there may be more. One is the public record. And the second one was the speed with which the credit report, that advantage of a year on the credit report. But why else?
You know, there are a few different reasons. And, you know, the work that I've done with consumers, you know, what I've always been really inspired by, Bruce, with Canadians is that we are a responsible lot. We like to take responsibility. And what the DCP allows a consumer to do is take full responsibility for their, you know, their challenges and repay that debt. And so Canadians like to do that. What they also do is they have access for, you know, up to 5 years they have access to a credit counselor and client services, as well as financial education. So it's a holistic approach to really supporting that consumer to not just pay off their debt, but live a debt-free life so that they don't have to keep coming back.
And obviously, given my day job, I am not objective on this, but I do want to give you the opportunity to make the point that nonprofit credit counselors are a great first call, because if a consumer proposal makes more sense, we're not making money. It is perfectly appropriate for a nonprofit credit counselor to make a referral to a client to do a consumer proposal with a licensed insolvency trustee.
You know what? Absolutely, Bruce. And I own my bias, you know, having worked in the industry and now that I work at the association, you know, I definitely do have a bias towards nonprofit credit counseling. But what I appreciate is that it's a free first call. So even if a DCP, a debt consolidation program, is not right for a consumer like Leanne, you know what, that credit counselor is going to find the right place for her. And that might be a consumer proposal. As you said, it's a free referral. And it's also a referral to a trusted licensed insolvency trustee, you know, who treats our clients with dignity and respect and, you know, behaves ethically and according to the bankruptcy standards.
You have been in this world a very, very long time. You have talked to a lot of clients over the years. Many, if not most of them, have an emotional hurdle to overcome for lots of different reasons. You know, some of it's shame, some of it's, you know, they feel like if they just try harder, there's a way to get out of it. What is the thing that you would say to those clients, and of which it's probably the majority, who are, they understand the math of it. They understand that this is a way for them mathematically to go to get to a better place, but they've got some sort of intangible block. What do you say to them?
You know, I think it's twofold. I think when it comes to shame, what I would remind people is that they're not alone. And we in Canada have associated net worth and self-worth, right, into one concept. If I'm good with my money, I'm a good person. And if I'm bad with my money, I'm a bad person. And those are fundamentally different concepts, right? You can be a good person and still not be great with money. Mm. So I always recommend people to just take a deep breath and remember you're not alone, and that a nonprofit credit counselor, you know, likely they've seen their own financial challenges in their own life, right? Because we're not immune to it. And they've seen a lot of other people, and they can come up with solutions that work for that person. So that's the first thing. In terms of I should just work harder, you know what? What I would ask people is, how long have you been working hard at this? Yeah. And what more do you think you can do? And maybe that's where you just need to reach out for a friendly face and a helping hand to look at your options, because a DCP may not be right for most people. That's okay. But you'll walk away with a plan, a budget, referrals, and resources. Not so bad for an hour's appointment.
Yeah. Stacy, thank you so much.
Always my pleasure, Bruce. Thank you for having me.
Stacy Yenchuk Alexi is the CEO of Credit Counseling Canada, and she joined us to talk about the differences between a debt consolidation program and a consumer proposal. Regardless of which solution you choose, regardless of whether you do anything differently, of course, I believe very strongly in the power that a nonprofit credit counselor can have, just talking about what your options are. Stay with us. Coming up next, McGill University finance professor Katrin Tin will be here to talk about why some central banks are exploring digital currencies and what this could mean for Canadians. I am, in addition to the show, I'm also the money columnist for CBC Radio. And every Wednesday afternoon, we dig into a topic relevant to you and your financial life. So how about we meet there too? That'd be fun.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Remember the dot-com boom and bust in the early 2000s? I remember it well. There was a time when it felt like dot-com businesses were a passing fad, right? Because so many of them cratered. Of course, nothing could be further from the truth. Amazon.com being case in point number one. The story of cryptocurrency, I think, might go the same way. So certain players may fail, some of them spectacularly, like the news of FTX, the exchange. But the idea of digital currency may survive, may well thrive, especially if the central banks get involved. And that's what seems to be happening, not just in Canada, but around the world. A number of developed economies are exploring this idea, trying to figure out how to make it work, where it fits within our traditional system, and what impact it will have on you and I, the consumers. Katrin Tin is an assistant professor of finance from the Desautels Faculty of Management at McGill University. She recently co-wrote a piece called Why Digital Currencies Could Change the Future of Central Banking. She joins us now to explain. Hello there.
Hello.
Why is the Bank of Canada even interested in this in the first place?
So the main reasons that they would say is that we know that cash use is going down in Canada, as well as in many other countries. People are increasingly using cards and other mobile payment means, for example. And additionally, as you just introduced, there are digital currencies that have emerged, be them like these decentralized systems like Bitcoin, but even some technology firms have been considering issuing their own forms of money.
And so I think it's important for us to distinguish between the currencies, like the Canadian dollar is a currency, and the speculation on the currency, because currency traders have been doing that for, you know, generations. It is recently that people have been speculating on crypto, but what the central banks are interested in, it sounds like it's more about how we could transact using digital currencies. Is that accurate?
Yes, this is accurate, because the main reasons of interest why many central banks are thinking about it is to effectively make the payment systems faster and more efficient, but also more inclusive, because even in countries like Canada, there is still a noticeable proportion of individuals that are either unbanked or underbanked, meaning they don't have a bank account or they don't use enough financial services. So speed, efficiency, and inclusion are some of the main reasons. Yeah.
What does a digital currency provide that the Canadian dollar in its digital form does not provide? Because right now I bank online. I'm not touching a piece of paper when I go to do an e-transfer. I'm moving money around digitally. How does this differ from that?
For the end user, things might look reasonably similar. So maybe there would be one day a Canadian digital dollar and the individual uses a mobile or a card or some other payment device to make a payment as they would use a bank card. There are, of course, some differences that happen in the bank background because this digital currency would be more similar to cash in the sense that it will not be according to some plans and be lent out to other users. So for example, the bank, when they are taking deposits, they are also making loans. So it's one should think of it being like a physical Canadian dollar that is in a digital form. Of course, a lot of open questions are still there of how the CBDCs would be designed. So the end version may be slightly different from what we are imagining now.
Mm. So your piece argues that digital currencies could and will change the future of central banking. Can you give us some examples of what could occur?
Yeah, so a few things that could occur. And in the conference that we recently organized, there were many interesting talks about it as well. So one worry that banks sometimes might have is that is it going to destroy their business model? But as I said before, one should think of the central bank's digital currency as a means of payment or like a physical cash rather than a tool for saving. So maybe it will be the case that that banks will need to offer higher deposit rates or higher rates to attract funds that they can invest to other businesses and firms. And that could reduce the profits. But there would be also some interesting arguments that have been put forward that is unlikely to destroy the financial services or unlikely to destroy banking. And second, one can take it even more excitedly, perhaps having this digital better tools, maybe it can even enhance financial services by financial innovation, for example.
What does it do to the Bank of Canada's ability to fight inflation? So historically, it was kind of like, oh, well, we'll just print money or we'll take money out of circulation. And I know it doesn't literally work like that today. But as you think about digital currencies and their number one job, does it make it easier or harder?
So absolutely. This is one of the key reasons why they are thinking about it. There is a fact that if people would not be using cash, let's take it to the extreme. Maybe everybody will not use Canadian dollars at all. They would all make payments in some advanced form of Bitcoin. Of course, that would reduce central bank's ability to conduct monetary policy. But in the way that it is imagined as really being a digital equivalent of cash, if it is adopted enough, then effectively, largely the central bank's tools to conduct monetary policy would stay similar.
Where is Canada compared to its global peer? Banks in other, I don't know, OECD countries, are we leading the pack or are we lagging the pack?
Canada is definitely one of the countries that started to think exploratorily on about the CBDCs reasonably early, like before a European Central Bank and before some southern neighbors in United States. At the moment, they don't have, to my knowledge, like a very fixed timeline. Unlike European central banks that is currently in an investigative stage and in next autumn, they are going to decide whether to go further to testing and pilot phases. So in a way, the European central bank has put up a more concrete timeline and dates, while the Canadian plan is very much in the active thinking process and very sophisticated, but they are not nailing down any specific dates. Mm.
What is the number one risk that the Bank of Canada faces as it works on this digital currency idea? If you were in the room with Tiff and all his officials, what would you say? Hey, don't forget about this.
Yes. So for my point of view, like definitely as a key consideration is regarding privacy and how to make the system so that it is protecting aspects of the privacy. So for example, protects well the individual's transaction records, but at the same time is still useful for forbidding things like money, like making it difficult to do money laundering and all sorts of other illegal activities. So for me, that is the most important trade-off that the specific design nuances need to solve. Of course, from the central bank's own perspective, I guess one of the big risks is that nobody wants to use it, so the adoption fails. But these two are like related. If it is attractive because of its features, like for example privacy, then it might also be more likely adopted and vice versa.
Interesting. Catherine, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Catherine Tin is an assistant professor of finance from the Desautels Faculty of Management at McGill University. She co-wrote a piece called Why Digital Currencies Could Change the Future of Central Banking. That is our show for today. A thank you to our sponsors, Credit Canada, first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. If you'd like to get in touch with us, very simple to do so. We're old school. Email ask@moolala.ca. ask@moolala.ca. You can send us your comments, your questions, your story ideas, your, your stock tips, your suggestions on what we should name a digital currency in Canada. You can also subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca. On social media, I'm at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry, Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.